Random House Audio presents The Girl Who Chased the Moon by Sarah Addison Allen. Read for you by Rebecca Lohman. Chapter 1. It took a moment for Emily to realize the car had come to a stop. She looked up from her charm bracelet, which she'd been worrying in slow circles around her wrist, and stared out the window. The two giant oaks in the front yard looked like flustered ladies caught mid-curtsy, their starched green leaf dresses swaying in the wind. "This is it?" she asked the taxi driver.
"6 Shelby Road, Mullaby. This is it."
Emily hesitated, then paid him and got out. The air outside was tomato-sweet and hickory-smoked, all at once delicious and strange. It automatically made her touch her tongue to her lips. It was dusk, but the streetlights weren't on yet. She was taken aback by how quiet everything was. It suddenly made her head feel light. No street sounds, no kids playing, no music or television. There was this sensation of otherworldliness, like she'd traveled some impossible distance. She looked around the neighborhood while the taxi driver took her 2 overstuffed duffel bags out of the trunk. The street consisted of large old homes, most of which were showpieces in true old movie Southern fashion, with their elaborate trim work and painted porches. The driver set her bags on the sidewalk beside her, nodded, then got behind the wheel and drove off. Emily watched him disappear. She tucked back some hair that had fallen out of her short ponytail, then grabbed the handles of her duffel bags. She dragged them behind her as she followed the walkway from the sidewalk, through the yard and under the canopy of fat trees. It grew dark and cold under the trees, so she picked up her pace. But when she emerged from under the canopy on the other side, she stopped short at the sight before her. The house looked nothing like the rest of the houses in the neighborhood. It had probably been an opulent white at one time, but now it was gray, and its Gothic Revival pointed arch windows were dusty and opaque. It was outrageously flaunting its age, spitting paint chips and old roofing shingles into the yard. There was a large wraparound porch on the first floor, the roof of which served as a balcony for the second floor, and years of crumbling oak leaves were covering both. If not for the single clear path formed by use up the center of the steps, it would have looked like no one lived there. This is where her mother grew up? She could feel her arms trembling, which she told herself was from the weight of the bags. She walked up the steps to the porch, dragging the duffel bags and a good many leaves with her. She set the bags down and walked to the door, then knocked once. No answer. She tried again. Nothing. She tucked her hair back again, then looked behind her as if to find an answer. She turned back and opened the rusty screen door and called into the house. "Hello?" The space sounded hollow. No answer. She entered cautiously. No lights were on, but the last sunlight of the day was coughing through the dining room windows directly to her left. The dining room furniture was dark and rich and ornate, but it seemed incredibly large to her, as if made for a giant. To her right was obviously another room, but there was an accordion door closing off the archway. Straight in front of her was a hallway leading to the kitchen and a wide staircase leading to the second story. She went to the base of the stairs and called up, "Hello?" At that moment, the accordion door flew open and Emily jumped back. An elderly man with coin-silver hair walked out, ducking under the archway to avoid hitting his head. He was fantastically tall and walked with a rigid gait, his legs like stilts. He seemed badly constructed, like a skyscraper made of soft wood instead of concrete. He looked like he could splinter at any moment.
"You're finally here. I was getting worried."
His fluid southern voice was what she remembered from their first and only phone conversation a week ago, but he was nothing like she expected. She craned her neck back to look up at him. "Vance Shelby?" He nodded. He seemed afraid of her. It flustered her that someone this tall would be afraid of anything, and she suddenly found herself monitoring her movements, not wanting to do anything to startle him. She slowly held out her hand.
"Hi, I'm Emily."
He smiled. Then his smile turned into a laugh, which was an ashy roar like a large fire. Her hand completely disappeared in his when he shook it.
"I know who you are, child. You look just like your mother when she was your age."
His smile faded as quickly as it had appeared. He dropped his hand, then looked around awkwardly.
"Where are your suitcases?"
"I left them on the porch."
There was a short silence. Neither of them had known the other existed until recently. How could they have run out of things to say already? There was so much she wanted to know.
"Well,"
he finally said,
"you can do what you want upstairs. It's all yours. I can't get up there anymore. Arthritis in my hips and knees. This is my room now."
He pointed to the accordion door.
"You can choose any room you want, but your mother's old room was the last one on the right. Tell me what the wallpaper looks like when you walk in. I'd like to know."
"Thank you, I will,"
she said, as he turned and walked away from her toward the kitchen, his steps loud in his wondrously large shoes. Emily watched him go, confused. That was it? She went to the porch and dragged her bags in. Upstairs she found a long hallway that smelled woolly and tight. There were 6 doors. She walked down the hall, the scraping of her duffel bags magnified in the hardwood silence. Once she reached the last door on the right, she dropped her duffel bags and reached to the inside wall for the light switch. The first thing she noticed when the light popped on was that the wallpaper had rows and rows of tiny lilacs on it, like scratch-and-sniff paper, and the room actually smelled a little like lilacs. There was a 4-poster bed against the wall, the torn, gauzy remnants of what had once been a canopy now hanging off the posts like maypoles. There was a white trunk at the foot of the bed. The name Dulcie, Emily's mother's name, was carved in it in swirly letters. As she walked by it, she ran her hand over the top of the trunk, and her fingertips came away with puffs of dust. Underneath the age, like looking through a layer of ice, there was a distinct impression of privilege to this room. It made no sense. This room looked nothing like her mother. She opened the set of French doors and stepped out into the balcony, crunching into dried oak leaves that were ankle-deep. Everything had felt so precarious since her mother's death, like she was walking on a bridge made of paper. When she'd left Boston, it had been with a sense of hope, like coming here was going to make everything okay. She'd actually been comforted by the thought of falling back into a cradle of her mother's youth, of bonding with the grandfather she hadn't known she had. Instead, the lonely strangeness of this place mocked her. This didn't feel like home. She reached to touch her charm bracelet for comfort, but felt only bare skin. She lifted her wrist, startled. The bracelet was gone. She looked down, then around. She frantically kicked the leaves on the balcony, trying to find it. She rushed back into the room and dragged her bags in, thinking maybe the bracelet had caught on one of them and slipped inside. She tossed her clothes out of them and accidentally dropped her laptop, which she'd wrapped in her white winter coat. But it wasn't anywhere. She ran out of the room and down the stairs, then she banged out of the front door. It was so dark under the canopy of trees now that she had to slow down until the light from the streetlights penetrated, then she ran to the sidewalk. After 10 minutes of searching, she realized that either she had dropped it on the sidewalk and someone had already taken it, or it had fallen out in the cab when she was toying with it, and it was now on its way back to Raleigh, where the cab had picked her up at the bus station. The bracelet had belonged to her mother. Dulcie had loved it, loved the crescent moon charm in particular. That charm had been worn thin by the many times Dulcie had rubbed it while in one of her faraway moods. Emily walked slowly back into the house. She couldn't believe she'd lost it. She heard what sounded like a clothes dryer door slam, Then her grandfather came out of the kitchen. "Lilacs," she said when he met her in the foyer, where she had stopped and waited for him to notice her so she wouldn't startle him. How odd that he was the giant, yet she was the one who felt out of place. He gave her a cautious look, like she was out to trick him.
"Lilacs?"
"You asked what the wallpaper was in Mom's old room. It's lilacs."
"Ah, it always was flowers. Usually roses when she was a little girl. It changed a lot as she got older. I remember once it was lightning bolts on a tall black background. And then another time it was this scaly blue color, like a dragon's belly. She hated that one, but couldn't seem to change it."
That made Emily smile. "That doesn't sound like her at all. I remember once..." She stopped when Vance looked away. He didn't want to know. The last time he saw his daughter was 20 years ago. Wasn't he even curious? Stung, Emily turned away from him. "I guess I'll go to bed now."
"Are you hungry?" he asked as he followed her at a distance. "I went to the grocery store this morning. I bought some teenager food."
She reached the first step on the staircase and turned, which made him step back suddenly. "Thank you, but I really am tired." He nodded.
"All right. Tomorrow, maybe."
She went back to the bedroom and fell onto the bed. Mustiness exploded from the mattress. She stared at the ceiling. Moths had come in, attracted to the light, and they were hopping around the cobwebby chandelier. Her mother had grown up with a chandelier in her bedroom? This from the same woman who would lecture Emily if she left a light on in a room she wasn't using? She reached over and pulled some of her clothes from the floor and buried her face in them. They smelled familiar, like her mother's incense. She squeezed her eyes shut, trying not to cry. It was too early to say this was a bad decision, and even if it was, there was nothing she could do about it. She could survive a year here, surely. She heard the wind skittering dried leaves around the balcony, something she realized sounded remarkably like someone walking around out there. She moved the clothes from her face and turned her head to look out the open balcony doors. The light from the bedroom illuminated the closest treetops in the backyard, but their limbs weren't swaying. She sat up and crawled off the bed. Once outside, she looked around carefully. "Is anyone here?" she called, not knowing what she would do if someone actually answered. Something suddenly caught her eye. She quickly stepped to the balustrade. She thought she saw something in the woodline beyond the gazebo in the overgrown backyard. There. There it was again. It was a bright white light, a quick zippy flash darting between the trees. Gradually the light faded, moving back into the darkness of the woods until it disappeared completely. "Welcome to Mullaby, North Carolina," she thought, "home of ghost lights, giants, and jewelry thieves." She turned to go back in and froze. There, on the old metal patio table, sitting on top of a layer of dried leaves, was her mother's charm bracelet, where it hadn't been just minutes ago. Too much wine. That's what Julia would blame it on. When she saw Stella in the morning, she would say, "Oh, and that thing I said about Sawyer last night, forget it. It was just the wine talking." As Julia made her way up to her apartment that evening, she felt vaguely panicked and not at all mellow, as summer wine on the back porch with Stella usually made her. She only had 6 months before she was free of this town again, 6 months that were supposed to be easy, the downhill slope of her 2-year plan. But with one tiny slip of the tongue, she'd just made things infinitely harder on herself. If what she said got back to Sawyer, he wouldn't let it rest. She knew him too well. She opened the door at the top of the staircase and stepped into the narrow hallway. Nothing had been done to the upper story of Stella's house to make it look like an apartment. There were 4 doors off the hallway. One led to the bathroom, one to Julia's bedroom, one to a second bedroom that had been converted into a kitchen, and another to a tiny third bedroom that Julia used as a living room. Years ago, after Stella's ex-husband had spent his way through Stella's trust fund, he'd decided they should bring in renters for extra money, so he'd put a long curtain at the top of the staircase and said, "Voila! Instant apartment!" Then he'd been surprised when there were no takers. Men of thoughtless actions are often surprised by consequences, Stella always said. The last year of his and Stella's marriage, he'd started leaving a fine black dust on everything he'd touched, proof of his black heart, Stella claimed. When she'd discovered the black dust on other women, sprinkled on the backs of their calves when they wore shorts on summer days and behind their ears when they wore their hair up, Stella had finally kicked him out. Afterwards, she got her brother to put a door at the top of the staircase and a sink and an oven hook up in one of the bedrooms, hoping something good might come from finishing something her lousy ex-husband had started. Julia was her first tenant. Initially, Julia had been uneasy about renting a place from one of her old high school enemies, but she'd had no choice. Stella's apartment had been the only place Julia could afford when she'd moved back to Mullaby. She'd been surprised to find that despite their pasts, she and Stella actually got along. It was an unlikely friendship, one Julia still didn't know how to explain. Stella had been one of the most popular girls at Mullaby High, a member of Sassafras, what the elite group of pretty, sparkly girls had called themselves. Julia had been the girl everyone avoided in the hallways. She'd been sullen and rude and undeniably strange. She'd dyed her hair bright pink, worn a studded leather choker every day, and used eyeliner so thick and black that she'd looked bruised. And her father had tried so hard not to notice. Julia walked down the hall to her bedroom. But before she turned on the light, she noticed a light coming from Vance Shelby's house next door. She went to her open window in the darkness and looked out. All the time she'd lived in Stella's house, all the sleepless nights she'd spent staring out this window, and she'd never once seen a light in the upstairs bedrooms next door. There was a teenager on the balcony. She was just standing there, as still as snow, staring into the woods behind Vance's house. She was willow branch thin, had a cap of yellow hair, and a sad sort of vulnerability was wafting from her, making the night smell like maple syrup. There was something familiar about her, and that's when Julia suddenly remembered. Vance's granddaughter was coming to live with him. This past week at Julia's restaurant, it was all anyone could talk about. Some people were curious, some were fearful, and some were outright mean. Not everyone had forgiven this girl's mother for what she'd done. Julia didn't like the thought of what the girl was in for. It made her feel stiff and anxious. Living down your own past was hard enough. You shouldn't have to live down someone else's. Tomorrow morning, Julia decided, she'd make an extra cake at the restaurant to take to her. Julia undressed and got in bed. Eventually, the light went off next door. She sighed and turned on her side and waited to cross another day off her calendar. After her father's death almost 2 years ago, Julia had taken a few days off work to come back to Mullaby to get his affairs in order. Her plan had been to quickly sell his house and restaurant, then take the money and go back to Maryland and finally make her dream of opening her own bakery come true. But things hadn't gone exactly the way they were supposed to. She'd quickly discovered that her father had been deeply in debt, his house and restaurant mortgaged to the hilt. Selling his house had paid off his home mortgage and a small part of his restaurant mortgage, but even with that, she would have barely broken even if she'd sold the restaurant then. So she came up with her now infamous 2-year plan. By living very frugally and bringing in more business to Jay's Barbecue while she was there, in 2 years she would have the mortgage paid off and could sell the restaurant for a tidy profit. She'd been perfectly upfront about it with everyone in town. She would be staying in Mullaby for 2 years, but that did not mean she lived here anymore. She was just visiting. That was all. When she took over the restaurant, Jay's Barbecue had a modest but loyal following, thanks to her father. He had a way of making people feel happy when they left, smelling of sweet yellow barbecue smoke that trailed behind them like a dress train. But Mullaby had more barbecue restaurants per capita than any other place in the state, so competition was fierce. With her father's personal touch now gone, Julia knew the restaurant needed something to set it apart from the rest. So she started baking and selling cakes, her specialty, and it was an instant boon to business. Soon, Jay's Barbecue was known not just for fine Lexington-style barbecue, but also for the best cakes and pastries around. Julia always got to the restaurant well before dawn, and the only person there before her was the pit cook. They rarely talked. He had his job, and she had hers. She left the day-to-day running of the place to the people her father had taught and trusted. Even though the barbecue business was in her bones, stuck there like spurs, she tried to stay as uninvolved as possible. She loved her father, but it had been a long time since she'd wanted to be like him. When Julia was a child, before she'd turned into a moody, pink-haired teenager, she used to follow him to work every day before school and gladly help with everything from waitressing to tossing wood into the smokehouse pit. Some of her best memories were of spending time with her father at Jay's Barbecue. But too much had happened since then for her to ever believe she could be that comfortable here again. So she came in early, baked that day's cakes, and left just as the first early bird customers arrived for breakfast. On good days, she didn't even see Sawyer. This, as it turned out, wasn't a good day.
"You'll never guess what Stella told me last night," Sawyer Alexander said, strolling into the kitchen just as Julia was finishing the apple stack cake she was going to take to Vance Shelby's granddaughter. Julia closed her eyes for a moment. Stella must have called him the moment Julia left her last night and went upstairs.
Sawyer stopped next to her at the stainless steel table and stood close. He was like crisp, fresh air. He was self-possessed and proud, but everyone forgave him for that, because charm sparkled around him like sunlight. Blue-eyed and blonde-haired, he was handsome, smart, rich, and fun to be around. And he was disgustingly kind, too, as all the men in his family were, filled to capacity with southern gentility. Sawyer drove his grandfather to Julia's restaurant every morning, just so he could have breakfast with his old cronies. "You're not supposed to be back here," she said as she put the last layer of cake on top of the dried apple and spice filling.
"Report me to the owner."
He pushed some of her hair behind her left ear, his fingers lingering on the thin pink streak she still dyed in her hair there.
"Don't you want to know what Stella told me last night?" he asked.
She jerked her head away from his hand as she put the last of the apple and spice filling on top of the cake, leaving the sides bare. "Stella was drunk last night."
"She said you told her that you bake cakes because of me."
Julia knew it was coming, but she stilled anyway. The icing spatula stopped mid-stroke. She quickly resumed spreading the filling, hoping he hadn't noticed.
"She thinks you have low self-esteem. She's trying to build up your ego."
He lifted one eyebrow in that insolent way of his.
"I've been accused of many things, but low self-esteem is not one of them."
"It must be hard to be so beautiful."
"It's hell. Did you really say that to her?"
She clanged the spatula into the empty bowl the filling had been in. Then she took both to the sink.
"I don't remember. I was drunk, too." "You never get drunk," he said.
"You don't know me well enough to make blanket statements like, 'You never get drunk.'" It felt good to say that. 18 years she'd been away. "Look how much I've improved," she wanted to say.
"Fair enough. But I do know Stella. Even when she drinks, I've never known her to lie. Why would she tell me that you bake cakes because of me if it wasn't true?"
"I bake cakes. You have an infamous sweet tooth. Maybe she got the two tangled up." She walked into the storage room for a cake box, taking longer than necessary, hoping maybe he'd give up and go away.
"You're taking a cake with you?"
he asked when she came back out. He hadn't moved. All the crazy hot activity in the kitchen, waitresses going in and out, cooks going back and forth, the constant thump of barbecue being hand-chopped, and he was so still. She had to quickly turn away. Staring at an Alexander man too long was like staring at the sun. The image became imprinted. You could close your eyes and still see him. "I'm giving it to Vance Shelby's granddaughter. She got in last night." That made him laugh. "You're actually giving someone a welcome cake?" She didn't realize the irony until he pointed it out to her. "I don't know what came over me." He watched her as she put the cake in the cardboard box. "I like this color on you," he said, touching the sleeve of her white, long-sleeved shirt. She immediately pulled her arm away. A year and a half of avoiding this man since she'd been back, then she had to go and say to Stella the one thing that would draw him to her like gravity. He'd been looking for this excuse since the moment she came back to town. He wanted to get closer to her, she knew that, and it made her angry. How could he even think of picking up where they left off, after what happened? She reached over and closed the window above her table. It was always the last thing she did every morning, and sometimes it made her sad. Another day, another call, unanswered. She picked up the cake box and took it with her out into the restaurant without another word to Sawyer. Jay's barbecue was plain, as most genuine barbecue restaurants in the South were. Linoleum floors, plastic tablecloths on the tables, heavy wooden booths. It was an homage to tradition. As soon as she'd taken over, Julia had pulled down the tattered NASCAR memorabilia her father had tacked to the far wall, but she'd been met with such protest that she'd had to put it all back up. She set the box down and picked up the chalkboard on the diner counter. She wrote the names of the day's cakes on the board. Traditional southern red velvet cake and peach pound cake, but also green tea and honey macaroons and cranberry donuts. She knew the more unusual things would sell out first. It had taken nearly a year, but she'd won over her regulars with her skill with what they already knew, so now they would try anything she made. Sawyer walked out just as she set the chalkboard back on the counter. "I told Stella I'd come over with pizza tonight. You'll be there?" "I'm always there. Why don't the two of you sleep together and get it over with?" Sawyer's Thursday pizza courtship of Stella had been going on ever since Julia had moved back to Mullaby. Stella swore there was nothing going on, but Julia thought Stella was being naive. Sawyer leaned in close. "Stella and I did sleep together," he said into her ear, "3 years ago, right after her divorce. And before you think that sounds indiscriminate, I try to keep my actions regret-free these days." She gave him a sharp look as he walked away. His casual, almost flippant, mention of it took her by surprise and made her feel cool and tart, like tasting lime for the first time. She couldn't blame him for being a scared teenager when he'd found out she'd gotten pregnant from their one night together on the football field all those years ago. She'd been a scared teenager, too, and they'd made the only decisions they were capable of making at the time, for better or worse. But she resented how easily he'd gotten on with his life. It had been just one night to him, one regretful night with the freaky, unpopular girl he'd barely even talked to at school, a girl who'd been madly in love with him. Oh, God, she wasn't going to fall into this role again. She couldn't. 6 months and counting, and she would leave this crazy place and never think of Sawyer again. With any luck. Chapter 2. When Emily woke, her hairline was wet with sweat, and she felt bone-tired. She also had absolutely no idea where she was. She sat up quickly and pulled the earbuds of her MP3 player out of her ears. She looked around the room, the lilac wallpaper, the tattered princess furniture. That's when she remembered. She was in her mother's old bedroom. She'd never slept in a place that felt so hollow. Even though she knew her grandfather was downstairs, having the entire upstairs to herself made her uneasy. All night there had been long periods of quiet, punctuated by loud wooden pops of the house settling, and leaves kept rattling outside her balcony door. She'd finally turned on her MP3 player and tried to imagine herself someplace else, someplace not so humid. Scared or not, tonight she was going to have to sleep with the balcony doors open, or else perish into a puddle of perspiration. At some point last night, she'd kicked the bedsheet aside, and she'd started out in pajamas, but she'd wiggled out of the bottom part soon after turning in, and was now in only the top. Her mother might have been the most politically correct person on the planet, an activist, an environmentalist, a crusader for the underdog, but even she ran the air conditioner when it got too hot. She made her way to the antiquated bathroom and took a bath because there was no shower, and she was momentarily stumped by the fact that there were separate faucets for hot and cold water instead of both coming out of the same faucet, like in a normal bathroom. Afterward, she dressed in shorts and a racerback tank, then went downstairs. She noticed the note taped to the inside of the screen door right away.
"Emily, this is Grandpa Vance writing you. I forgot to tell you that I go out for breakfast every morning. Didn't want to wake you. I'll bring you something back. But there's also teenager food in the kitchen."
The note was written in large block letters that slanted off the lines of the paper as if he couldn't see around his hand as he was writing. She took a deep breath, still trying to rearrange her expectations. Her first day here, and he didn't want to spend it with her? Standing at the screen door, Emily heard a swish of leaves and, startled, looked up to see a woman in her 30s walking up the front porch steps. She had light brown hair that was cut into a beautiful swinging bob just below her ears. Emily could never get her own bobbed hair to look like that. She'd been trying to grow it out forever and could only manage a short ponytail with it, and even then it fell out of the tail and around her face most of the time. The woman didn't see Emily standing there until she reached the top step. She instantly smiled. "Hello, you must be Vance's granddaughter," she said as she came to a stop at the door. She had pretty, dark brown eyes.
"Yes, I'm Emily Benedict."
"I'm Julia Winterson. I live over there." She turned her head slightly, indicating the yellow and white house next door. That's when Emily noticed the pink streak in Julia's hair, tucked behind her ear. It wasn't something she expected from someone so fresh-faced, in flower-stained jeans and a white peasant blouse. "I brought you an apple stack cake." She opened the white box she was holding and showed Emily what looked like a stack of very large brown pancakes with some sort of filling in between each one. "It means," she struggled with the word, then finally said, "welcome. I know Mullaby has its faults, as I'm sure your mother told you, but it's also a town of great food. You're going to eat very well while you're here. At least there's that." Emily couldn't remember the last time she'd had an appetite for anything, much less food, but she didn't tell Julia that.
"My mother didn't tell me anything about Mullaby," Emily said, staring at the cake.
"Nothing?"
"No."
Julia seemed shocked into silence.
"What?"
Emily looked up from the cake.
"It's nothing," Julia said, shaking her head.
She closed the lid on the box. "Do you want me to put this in the kitchen?"
"Sure."
"Come in," Emily said as she opened the screen door for her. As Julia walked in, she noticed the note from Grandpa Vance still on the screen. "Vance asked me to take him grocery shopping yesterday morning so he could get some things for you," she said, nodding toward the note. "His idea of teenager food was Kool-Aid, fruit roll-ups, and gum. I convinced him to buy chips, bagels, and cereal, too."
"That was nice of you," Emily said. "To take him shopping, I mean."
"I was a big fan of the Giant of Mullaby when I was a kid."
When Emily looked at her, not understanding, Julia explained, "That's what people around here call your grandfather."
"How tall is he?"
Emily asked, her voice hushed as if he might hear. Julia laughed. It was a great laugh, and hearing it was like stepping into a spot of sunshine.
That she came bearing cake seemed oddly fitting. It was like she was made of cake, light and pretty and decorated on the outside with her sweet laugh and pink streak to her hair. But it was anyone's guess what was on the inside. Emily suspected it might be something dark. "Tall enough to see into tomorrow," that's what he tells everyone. "He's over 8 feet tall, I know that much. World record keepers came nosing around here once, but Vance wouldn't have anything to do with them." Julia knew the way to the kitchen, so Emily followed. The kitchen was large and kitschy, like something straight out of the 1950s. Years ago, it must have been a showplace. It was overwhelmingly red. Red countertops, red and white tile floor, and a large red refrigerator that had a silver pull handle, like a meat locker. Julia put the cake box on the counter, then turned to stare at Emily for a moment. "You look a lot like your mother," she finally said. "You knew her?" Emily asked, perking up at the thought of finding someone willing to talk about her mother. "We were in the same class in school, but we weren't close." Julia stuffed her hands into her jeans pockets. "She didn't tell you anything?" "I knew she was born in North Carolina, but I didn't know where. I didn't even know I had a grandfather." Julia's eyebrows rose, and Emily found herself rushing to explain. "She never said I didn't have one. She just never talked about him, and I always assumed it was because he had passed away. Mom didn't like to talk about her past, and I respected that. She always said there was no use dwelling on the unfixable past when there was so much you could do to fix the future. She devoted all her time to her causes." "Her causes?" "Amnesty International, Oxfam, Greenpeace, the Nature Conservancy. She traveled a lot when she was younger. After I was born, she settled down in Boston. She was very involved locally there."
"Well, that's not what I expected."
"Was she like that here? Was she involved in a lot of causes?" Julia quickly took her hands out of her pockets. "I should be going." "Oh," Emily said, confused. "Well, thank you for the cake."
"No problem. My restaurant is called Jay's Barbecue on Main Street. Come by any time for the best cake in Mullaby. The barbecue's really good, too, but I can't take credit for it. That's where your grandfather is right now, by the way. He walks there every morning for breakfast."
Emily followed Julia to the front door. "Where is Main Street?" As they stepped onto the porch, Julia pointed. "At the end of Shelby Road here, turn left onto Dogwood. About a half mile later, turn right. You can't miss it." Julia started toward the steps, but Emily stopped her.
"Wait, Julia. I saw some sort of light in the backyard last night. Did you see it?"
Julia turned. "You've seen the Mullaby lights already?"
"What are the Mullaby lights?"
Julia scratched her head and tucked her hair behind her ears, as if deciding what to say. "They're white lights that sometimes dart through the woods and fields around here. Some say it's a ghost that haunts the town. It's just another town oddity," she said, as if there were many. "Don't pay any attention to it, and it will go away." Emily nodded. Julia turned to leave again, but stopped with her back to Emily. She finally turned around and said, "Listen, I'll be next door if you ever need me, at least for the next 6 months. This place takes some getting used to. Believe me, I know." Emily smiled, and she felt her shoulders lose some tension. "Thanks." It didn't take Emily long to decide to walk to Main Street and greet her grandfather. She thought it would be nice to walk home with him, establish some sort of routine. He'd obviously lived alone for a long time, so maybe his hesitancy around her came from simply not knowing how to act. "Don't wait for the world to change, Emily," her mother used to say to her, sometimes in a frustrated voice. "Change it yourself." Emily wondered if her mother had been disappointed in her. She didn't have her mother's passion, her courage, her drive. Emily was cautious, but her mother had never met a person she didn't want to help. It had been an awkward dynamic. Emily had always been in awe of her mother, but it had been hard to get close to her. Dulcie had wanted to help, but never be helped. She found Main Street easily. Just like Julia said, there really was no missing it. Once she turned the corner off Dogwood, there was an enormous sign declaring that she was now on Historic Main Street. It was a long, beautiful street, different from the comfortable neighborhoods she'd walked through to get there. The street began with brick mansions in grand federal style, sitting close to the sidewalk with almost no front yards to speak of. Across the street from the mansions was a park with a bandstand that had a lovely silver crescent moon weather vane on top of it. Past the houses and the park, the street turned commercial, with a series of touristy shops and restaurants squeezed side by side into old brick buildings. Emily counted 7 barbecue restaurants, and she was only halfway down the business end of the street. 7. They were obviously the source of the smell that settled over the town like a veil. Woody, sweet smoke was rising from behind some of the restaurants in wisps and curls. There were a lot of tourists around, mesmerized, as she was, by Mullaby's old-fashioned beauty. The sidewalks were crowded, more crowded than she'd expected at that time of morning. She kept looking, but she couldn't see Jay's barbecue, and out of nowhere, panic set in. One moment she was feeling happy and proactive, walking along this beautiful street, and the next moment she was terrified that she couldn't find the restaurant she was looking for. What if Julia had been wrong? What if Grandpa Vance wasn't here? What if she couldn't find her way back? She started to feel lightheaded. It was like being underwater, this pressure against her eyes and ears, always followed by sparkling confetti swimming along her periphery. She'd been having these anxiety attacks ever since her mother died. It was easy enough to hide them from Mary, her mother's best friend, with whom Emily had lived for the past 4 months. All she had to do was close her bedroom door. And at school, her teachers would turn a blind eye when she stayed in the girls' restroom, sitting on the floor by the sinks, trying to catch her breath instead of coming to class. The business end of Main Street was lined with benches, so she made it to the nearest one and sat. She'd broken out into a cold sweat. She wouldn't faint. She wouldn't. She leaned forward and rested her chest against her thighs, her head down. The length of the thigh bone is indicative of overall height. It was a random thought, something she remembered from physiology class. A pair of expensive men's loafers suddenly appeared on the sidewalk in front of her. She slowly looked up. It was a young man about her age, wearing a white summer linen suit, the jacket pushed away from his hips by his hands resting casually in his trouser pockets. He had on a red bow tie, and his dark hair was curling around his starched collar. He was handsome in a well-bred kind of way, like something out of a Tennessee Williams play. She unexpectedly felt self-conscious in her shorts and racerback tank top. Compared to him, she looked like she'd just come from a spin class. He didn't say anything to her at first, just stared at her. Then he finally, almost reluctantly, asked, "Are you all right?" She didn't understand. Everyone she'd met here so far treated her as if associating with her was going to hurt. She took a deep breath, the oxygen going to her head with the force of flood water. "Fine, thanks," she said. "Are you sick?" "Just lightheaded." She looked down at her feet in ankle socks and cross trainers and seemed strangely detached from herself. Socks that only cover the ankle are not acceptable. Socks must be crew or knee socks only. So said the Roxley School for Girls handbook. She'd been at Roxley School all her school career. Her mother had helped found it, a school to empower girls, encouraging activism and volunteerism. Silence. She looked up again, and the young man was gone, like smoke. Had she been hallucinating? Maybe she'd conjured up some out-of-time southern archetype to go along with her surroundings. After a few minutes, she put her elbows on her knees and lifted herself, just slightly. She felt someone take a seat beside her on the bench, and she caught a nice, clean scent of cologne. The loud aluminum crack of a soda can being opened startled her, and she sat all the way up with a jerk. The young man in the white linen suit had returned. He was sitting beside her now, extending a can of Coke. "Go on," he said. "Take it." She reached for the can, her hand shaking slightly. She took a long drink, and it was cold, sweet, and so sharp it made her tongue burn. She couldn't remember the last time something had tasted this good. She couldn't stop drinking. In no time she had emptied the can. When she finished, breathless, she closed her eyes and pressed the cold can against her forehead. When was the last time she'd had something to drink? When she thought back, it was long before she'd gotten on the bus in Boston yesterday. She heard a crackling of paper. The young man said, "Don't be alarmed." And she felt something cold on the back of her neck, freezing. Her hand went instantly to her neck, covering his hand with hers. "What is that?" she demanded. "I believe it's a creamsicle," he said, leaning back to look at it. "It was the first thing I grabbed from the freezer in the general store." For the first time, she noticed that they were sitting in front of a deliberately old-fashioned place called Zim's General Store. The door was propped open, and Emily could see large barrels of candy near the cash register and an entire wall of vintage reproduction tin signs in the back. "It's mostly for the tourists, so it's been a long time since I've been in there," he said, "but it still smells like cinnamon and floor polish. Are you still with me? How are you feeling?" She turned back to him and realized just how close he was, close enough to see that his ivy-green irises were rimmed in black. Strangely, she thought she could actually feel him, feel a sort of energy emanating from him, like heat from a fire. He was so odd and lovely. For a moment, she was completely under his spell. She'd been staring at him for a while before she realized what she was doing. Then she also realized her hand was still on his, on her neck. She slowly moved her hand and shifted away. "I'm fine now, thank you." He took the paper-covered creamsicle off her neck and held it out to her, but she shook her head. He shrugged and unwrapped it. He took a bite as he sat back and crossed his legs, studying the store in front of them. She almost wished she'd taken the creamsicle now. It looked delicious. Cool vanilla and sharp, bright orange. "I'm Emily Benedict," she said, extending her hand. He didn't turn to her, nor did he take her hand. "I know who you are." He took another bite of the creamsicle. Emily's hand fell to her lap. "You do?" "I'm Wynne Coffey. My uncle was Logan Coffey." She looked at him blankly. This was obviously something he thought she should know. "I just moved here." "Your mother didn't tell you?" "Her mother? What did her mother have to do with this? Tell me what?" He finally turned to her. "Good God, you really don't know." "Know what?" This was beginning to concern her. He stared at her for an uncomfortably long time. "Nothing," he finally said, as he threw away what was left of the creamsicle in a receptacle by the bench, then stood. "If you're not feeling well enough to walk home on your own, I can call our driver to take you." "I'll be fine." She lifted the can slightly. "Thank you for the Coke." He hesitated. "I'm sorry I refused to shake your hand. Forgive me." He held out his hand. Confused, she took it. She was immediately shocked by the warmth of him, stretching out to her like wandering vines. He made her feel tangled in him, somehow. It wasn't exactly a bad feeling, just strange. He released her hand, and she watched him walk down the sidewalk. His skin almost glowed in the morning summer sun, which was slanting across the buildings in blinding golds and tangerines. He looked so alive, shining with it. For a moment, she couldn't look away.
"Emily?"
She turned and saw her giant grandfather walking toward her, carrying a paper bag. People were parting on the sidewalk, watching him in awe. She could tell he was trying not to notice, but his enormous shoulders were hunched, as if attempting to make himself smaller. She stood and tossed the can of Coke into a nearby recycling container. Vance came to a stop in front of her.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked. "I thought I'd meet you, so we could walk home together." The look on his face was almost indecipherable, but if she had to guess, she'd just made him sad. She was horrified. "I'm sorry," she immediately said. "I didn't mean to..."
"Was that Wynn Coffey you were talking to?"
"Do you know him?" Vance stared down the sidewalk. Emily couldn't see Wynn anymore, but Vance's height obviously gave him an advantage.
"Yes, I know him," he said. "Let's go home."
"I'm sorry, Grandpa Vance."
"Don't apologize, child. You did nothing wrong. Here, I brought you an egg sandwich from the restaurant."
He handed the bag to her. "Thank you." He nodded and put one impossibly long arm around her, then walked her home in silence. Chapter 3
"You'll never guess who I met today," Wynn Coffey said as he stood in front of the large sitting room window and watched a whale of gray sky swallow the pink evening light. There was a sound of ticking heels on the white marble floor of the foyer, and Wynn could see the reflection of his mother as she entered the room, followed by Wynn's younger sister. His mother sat beside his father on the couch, and his sister crossed the room to the settee. Wynn's father, Morgan, folded his newspaper and set it aside. He took off his reading glasses and focused on Wynn, not his wife. It had been a long time since Wynn's parents had really looked at each other. They seemed like ghosts to each other now, only ever seen out of the corners of their eyes.
"Who did you meet?"
Right on schedule, the blinds began to automatically lower in the sitting room. Wynn waited until the window was completely covered, shutting out his view, before turning around. The room smelled of cold oranges and was filled with antique furniture, Federal-style highboys and couches tastefully upholstered in blue and gray florals. It was just so old, so familiar. Nothing ever changed. "Emily Benedict." Her name was instantly recognized. His father's anger was sudden and tangible. It charged the air with hot currents. Wynn silently returned his father's stare, not backing down.